Hello everyone, and welcome to The Deep Dive. Today you are going to hear part 2 of our discussion with Jesse Quill about The Walking Dead Season 1. The Walking Dead is a choice-driven, consequence-heavy narrative based on the comic of the same name, developed by Telltale Games, with directors Sean Veneman, Jake Rodkin, Dennis Leonard, Eric Parsons, Nick Herman, and Sean Ainsworth. It is written by Sean Veneman, Mark Darren, and Gary Guida, with a wonderful score by Jared Emerson Johnson. Now, of course, as always, we do not only recommend that you have listened to part 1 of our Walking Dead episode, but have also played the game before listening, because we are going to dive deep, and in the abyss, there be spoilers. Without further ado, let's descend.
This is not related to The Walking Dead, but I remember reading on Quora or Reddit, one of the two, somebody was having a midlife crisis and they were just talking about how they left everything of their old life behind. They got a divorce, they quit their job, they totally, like, you know, did all the stuff, and people said, oh, you're having a midlife crisis. And they said, actually, it was the best thing that I ever did, and I don't consider it a midlife crisis, because one day I just realized that I wouldn't trust an 18-year-old to make all of my decisions for me. Yet that's exactly what I'm doing. I'm living the life that my 18-year-old self did and put aside and made those decisions, and that's dumb. So I'm just going to stop and make all my decisions now, like what I want to do and what, you know, my educated, like, you know, experienced life self would do. And I just remember reading that going, oh, my God, we do that all the time. You know, we're told that we have to know what we want to do at 17 and go to school for what we want to do and all that stuff. And it's imperative that we constantly reassess kind of where we are and what we've learned and what decisions would be different now.
Absolutely. It's crazy. I totally agree with that. Yeah. Every birthday and every new year, I always take, sometimes it's only a few minutes and sometimes it's a whole day. It depends on how the year went.
Yeah.
But just thinking about, like, am I happy with the way that I progress my relationship with my husband? Am I happy with how I'm maintaining my relationship with my siblings and my parents? Am I satisfied in the job and that I have currently and how it's contributing to society and humanity's future for some sort of good?
Like, you are a badass. I don't do that.
It's hard. I think, like, 2 years ago and a year ago, it was really, really difficult. But, like, this year, I'm really happy with, like, the way the things are. And just being able to cut the fat out and realize when things get toxic or when things just aren't going the way that I really want them to anymore. It's okay to have conflict. It's okay to have disagreement. But when it's consistent and when it's something that's constantly a thorn in my side and when I have anxiety
and causing just stress,
just when thinking about it, it's like, I just don't have time for that. And as life goes on, I'm going to have less and less time for people or situations or environments like that. And so I'm not going to do it anymore. And so just realizing, like, I don't really agree with this, but, like, okay, so my husband, he doesn't drink at all. He's never he's never drank alcohol once in his life, and he doesn't plan to. And so I always kind of joke around whenever we go to events, oh, I'm drinking for the both of us or something. And there are times I never black out, but I definitely drink to the point of being slightly more than tipsy. So I'm silly and I might stumble a little bit and so on. And he's brought it up a few times and he's like, you know, I think you drink a lot. And it's never affected my ability to go to my job. I've never been angry or lashing out or, like, overly depressive during a drinking episode or during the hangover or whatever. But I've realized, like, what is alcohol really doing for me? Like, yeah, it might loosen me up when I'm at a party or something, but do I really need to have, like, 5 drinks? Maybe just one really good beer that sounds amazing, or, like, one really well-mixed drink, and then, okay, I'm loose, I'm, like, you know, smiley or whatever, and then that's good to go. I don't need to go crazy. And so I've been trying to make that change. So my job, for instance, they always have Thirsty Thursdays. So from, like, 6 to 8, they have beer and alcohol and wine and, like, all these different hors d'oeuvres and stuff in the office. And I just go home because I don't want to be around that type of environment personally anymore, because I don't find that party life. I never really found it like interesting very much anyway. Like, yeah, I might go to a concert. Yeah, I might go to an event or something, but it wasn't something that I constantly did every night or every weekend. And that's what a lot of either my coworkers or my current friends that are around my age do. And it's just like, I don't want to be a part of that anymore because it's kind of straining my husband, who doesn't do any of those things at all. So when we go to those events, like, he just has water, and then 2 hours later, everyone else is drunk, and it's kind of annoying to, like, get me home, because I know, like, oh, I'm with my husband, I could do whatever I want, and he'll get me home, right? But I'm putting undue stress on him. There's no reason for me to do it. So, like, there are times where, like, I don't drink at all at events anymore, or I just might have one drink, and it's just so much better, because I don't get hungover, yeah. And I'm not having unnecessary calories because we're in this like super crazy health kick where we're going to the gym all the time and we're making our meals for work and so on. So it's like, oh, this is this extra thing that's holding me back to that goal. So let's slowly cut it out to the point of me not needing or wanting it anymore. But there are times where I'm like, I really want sake with my sushi, but I don't have to have it every time. And I don't have to have 2 or 3 servings of it. And that's okay. So I don't know what the point of that was. I kind of forget the prompt, but
I have to ask you, do you struggle with identity in any of that? Like, oh, I like either somebody goes, oh, are you dry, or, you know, that kind of stuff where they immediately have to know why you refuse to drink. Like, do you ever, because I didn't drink, ever, because alcoholism ran in my family. So I was just petrified to even taste it. And then when I was, I'd say 24, I said, okay, I don't want to live in constant fear of a thing I've never even done or tried or allowed myself to experience to know if I can even trust myself. You know, like, I just don't want that to be my experience. And occasionally I have a very good friend who is dry and will be like, no, I don't drink. And I have a struggle with identity in that moment where I go, I used to be that person.
Yes, I used to be that person too.
Yes.
I used to be straight edge, I think is what we called it in high school.
Yeah.
And no drugs, no alcohol, no vices, like all of those sort of things, like a pure body or whatever. And that was my identity for a really long time.
Yeah.
And I don't really remember exactly what happened. I think it's just one of those things where it's like one of my friends turned 21 and we all were at a house because someone had a house off campus. So we were able to have alcohol because we went to a Catholic university. So it was a dry campus. So none of us really had alcohol except for when we went out. And they had whiskey and vodka and like coolers and all these like different beers and so on and so forth. And I finally tried it and it was like piss water, basically. It was a keg that was, you know, one of those really pale beers that was watered down even more. And but it was my first time drinking. I think I was like 20 and a half or something, so like technically illegal. Oh my god, I'm sorry, but you know,
well, Canada, it's fine.
So so I mean, I was just, you know what, 200 miles away from that from that border, so who knows. So I did it, and then I remember, like, the party was winding down and we had to drive back to campus, but we didn't have a big enough car and, like, someone else had a car and I was like, oh, I can drive. And then I was with Jeff and he was looking at me and it was like, you're drunk. And I'm like, no, I'm not. I'm sober. I'm fine. It was my first time drinking. And then I realized, like, oh my gosh, I'm actually not. And, it was something that was really difficult for me to get over, that I've kind of ruined that streak, but it's...
But why does that matter to us so much? You know, what is it about, you know, is it really about purity? Like, what, it, or is it just...
Belonging to a group.
Yeah,
that's
belonging
what it is.
To a group probably, and also just feeling like, you know, again, for me, I
know
feel
yourself.
Like it goes back to knowing myself, you know, and the comfort and the control that I have and knowing... No, I don't. This is who I am. And then just not being that person anymore. I think that's weird.
It made me feel weird for a while and then I quickly got over it.
Yeah.
but I definitely can see how that it's a point of contention within yourself. Cognitive dissonance. You have this idea of yourself and then you start making decisions that totally go against it. And you're like, oh, this is really confusing. And how do I resolve this? And some people never really get over that.
Yeah. I just, I wish that we were taught that it's not black and white all the time.
No, it never like, is, and it never should be.
You can do 90% of your life dry if you want and have a drink, and it's not the end of the world. You can also go your whole life dry. It's not the end of the world. You know, like, it doesn't have to define you in such a fundamental way, but I guess because we're always trying to put people in boxes so that we can understand and classify people, you know, and identify, that we get caught up in that. But
We quickly judge people to see if they are fit to spend more time and effort on. Yep. And so if you know of, like, another dry person, it's like one of those things that you want to attach to because it's such a rare thing in young adult culture. And so it's like, oh my gosh, we should be friends because we have this huge thing that's a big part of our identity in common, because we don't really get invited out to these parties because everyone knows that we don't drink anyway.
Yeah.
And then when we do go, everyone is just uses us as a designated driver or making sure that we get into our Ubers or in our...
Or
in
they
our...
have less fun because they are looking at you and you're the only one that's not drinking. Mm-hmm. And then they're just kind of like, you know, you really don't make these parties fun, so I'm sorry. Yeah. But like...
Yeah, definitely.
And then what do? You just watch a whole bunch of, like, for my 19th birthday party, everyone got wasted and I was, this is my birthday, dry, and everybody else is wasted. I was like holding my friend's head up while they puked in the toilet of my house. And I was just like, cool. I guess this is a fun experience. I just never saw the appeal to it. It's not that I ever thought that I was, you know, I wanted to be pure of anything. I lived in terror of, you know, what ran in my family, and B, I just was just not interested. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I struggle with the identity on that sometimes a little bit.
I think for my husband, it's a point of pride for him at this point. Mm. He's about to turn 27 and he's never had alcohol. Yeah. So it's like, it's a rare thing because it's not many people can say that. Mm-hmm. Like, even if I just stop drinking right now, I have 3 years of me drinking almost once every week. So it's like, oh, but you're kind of pure right now. Yeah. But you had that mean streak for a little bit in your early 20s. So it's like, oh, well. So it makes you feel lesser according to that group. You've lost you basically have closed off a dialogue option, a choice, like a tree choice, because of a decision that you made early on. And that goes away same way with being dry too. Like, so if you're dry, you've made that decision, and that affects the way that people invite you to parties and view you if you do go to those parties, and just view you in general because, oh, why are you dry? Do you think you're better than me because you are? Yep. Well, no, it's
it's projection city. That and a plant-based diet, man. I have never been harassed more in my entire life than when I went to a plant-based diet for my fucking heart condition. Mm-hmm. So many people are on my ass about that I just don't. I don't talk about it anymore. I don't, you know, people will be like, oh, you're this. And I'll be like, yep. And that's it. I don't want to talk about it because I don't think you want to talk about it either. You just want to project in my face. You want to, like, project vomit all over me. And I don't want that.
Tell me all the reasons why I'm wrong.
Yeah. Yep. Go for it. You know, or, oh, I could never do that, or blah, blah, blah. I'm like, cool. Great. Like, wait till you have heart condition and you're gonna die, then you'll do it. I loved cheese, I loved steak, like, I love all these things, but I did it. You can do it too, I'm sure. It's just the detachment and the insensitivity, I think, that, you know, just shocks you for a while, but then after a while you're like, okay, this is just how people are gonna act. They're gonna automatically assume that you're dry because either you had a drinking problem at one point, or because you think you're better than everybody.
Yeah, even that's though you 90% don't. Of the answer.
Yeah, they always think like, okay, well, and then they get really standoffish, like, oh, okay, you don't approve of me. The most common thing that I get is like, oh, I'm having a turkey sandwich. Is that okay? Like,
oh my god,
that is the number one reaction people have around, like, meat food. And I'm like, oh yeah, bacon's great, smells great, like, enjoy that, have fun. Like, I'm not gonna throw paint on you. Like, what do you think is gonna happen here? Like, I don't know.
I can get, like, if someone is genuine about it, like, oh, do you have an ethical concern of like, you don't even want to sit on my leather couch sort of thing. Like, let me make sure that you're comfortable. Versus,
but like, who does that? Someone's gonna. Maybe people do exist that are like this. I'd love to know. But if somebody invites you over to their house and they happen to have fur or something, or you know, animal stuff, are you gonna say something?
I've encountered someone like that. Yeah. Yep. Where they came over and
insert foot in mouth. I didn't know that was a thing.
Yeah.
So
yeah. Maybe. And okay. It's like, oh, what is your couch made of? It looks like, you know, leather. And it's like, yeah, it's genuine leather. And it's like, can I get another seat? And it's like, I mean, yeah, I have wooden dining room tables. How about that? Like,
yeah.
And they did it. So it's like,
oh, that's weird.
I get
the animal's already gone. The money is already spent. Like,
I think part of
doing?
It is like they don't want to be a part of wearing down that material, so it needs to be replaced faster. So if they can't be a part of as much as they can put themselves away from that, like, I'm not sitting on that leather chair, and then what if my sitting on it makes it crack, and then therefore you want to reupholster it or whatever the proper terminology is, I'm a part of that issue that is going on. I get it ethically, I understand, but it's also at the point where you're like inconveniencing others, and trying to navigate that properly is really difficult.
Yeah. Also, if I felt that way, I can totally understand that. When you put it that way, I get it. From a ethical standpoint, I understand that, and I can respect that. However, in that case, don't ask if it's made out of leather and make your friend feel like shit.
Just there's a better way to go through it.
Back support, and so you're gonna sit on the wooden table chair because your back feels better or something. You know, like,
right.
Those are one of those instances where I would just be like, oh, I'll actually sit over here because I'm much more comfortable or something, rather than being like, is your couch made out of leather? I'm not gonna sit on that.
Yeah, exactly.
I do understand though, sometimes when people first transition for whatever the reason, whether it's health or whatever, I do know that there is a period of
obsession.
Shock and obsession, as it were. Like, a lot of people that I've met that have either gone, you know, vegetarian or vegan for strictly ethical reasons will go through a period of like horror, like, why wasn't I told this, or why didn't I know these things, and so now I'm going to try to show everybody earthlings or everybody this. And it's just kind of like, not everybody wants to see that. And you don't need to see those things to do this or make a change. So I realize people get a little bit aggressive, or for a good example, for the health reason. So when I made my change about 6 or 7 years after, my father-in-law was at the doctor, and his cholesterol was in the red zone, and they wanted to put him on like Lipitor, I think it was. Mm-hmm. And my husband said, I implore you, please, I never ask you anything, just try this for a month, try what we do now and see what happens. And he did, and it worked. He went all the way down into the green, into cholesterol, and it worked for him. And I realize it's not the solution for everybody in every health issue that they have, but he then went on a crusade after that. He told everybody. He was like, no, you need to be eating this, and have you tried this, and oh, you're having this kind of chronic pain, change this, do this. And it's like, not everybody, you know, now you're that militant kind of like, and not everybody is receptive to that sort of thing. So
people who just find atheism or are reborn Christian, so both sides of that are very similar in their crusade. Yeah.
I was that way. I was very religious growing up because that's how I was brought up. And then when I made the switch afterwards, I was an angry atheist for sure. Yeah. I was like, and then anytime religion would come up, I would just feel enraged. But I had to step back and go, I'm feeling rage because I feel personally betrayed in that I did not know other possibilities existed. You know, I feel like I had the wool pulled over my eyes by somebody purposefully, you know, like I felt, you know, attacked in that way. So it took me being like, okay, well, not everybody is that way, and you need to reconcile with that to no longer even be necessarily an atheist. Like, I don't know. I don't have the answers. I just know what I kind of don't believe and what I'm okay with, and sure, that's a possibility. I think they call that agnostic. So it's like, You know, I don't really know. And I'm okay with that. I don't need to have an answer one way or the other. So
do you really need to have an answer on the way that you might act in a apocalypse? Or should you just wing it?
I love that you just like brought that all the way back. Well, no, now that I know that it's like, you know, my fear is rooted in this like one shameful incident in particular. I don't know. I think bring it on, zombie apocalypse. No, I'm kidding. But
Give it a, you know, I think it's about if you have this thought process of like, okay, well, if this happened, then I would just want to end my life because I want it to be on my terms. It can always be on your terms.
Yeah, that's true.
Doesn't have to be that day or the next day.
Yeah.
You know,
you can always at every point make a decision for who you want to be rather than how your experiences shaped you. Everly. That's my friend Everly said that to me.
You always have a choice.
Yeah, you do.
You always have a choice. And I mean, that's what this game is about. I think where it kind of gets a little bit tougher is, you know, yeah, you always have a choice, but you have, you know, in that world, you don't have nearly as much time to think about the choices that you're making as we do now.
Yeah.
Right.
You know,
I think
nowadays we can sit down and we can plan things out and we can look at every possibility. But, you know, if you have a horde of zombies barreling down on you and, you know, it's like you have to boom, you know, I'm going to make this choice and I'm going to live with it. And whatever the consequences are, I'm going to deal with them. And like, that's it. That's where a lot of that fear comes from.
Oh, man. I don't know if I necessarily disagree with you because you did say like it's all about choice, especially in the Walking Dead series. I think you obviously do make a lot of choices, either dialogue options or go, you know, oh, I'm going to go to the mansion or I'm going to go to down the street or whatever, those kind of things. And they change who comes with you, who doesn't, who survives that part of the episode, who comes along at the end of the season and so on. But in the end, Lee, one of my favorite quotes in like the whole entire series, in the first episode of the first season to Kenny after they had that situation with Larry and Doug in the pharmacy.
Yeah.
Lee and Kenny are talking about how, oh, we could have saved Sean if we just worked a little bit harder. And Lee says, you think you do have a choice when you look back, but in the moment when things are really out of control, you don't have any choice.
Back on Herschel's farm.
Yeah.
I panicked, you know. I'm not proud of it.
It happens.
I guess. But I can't stop seeing him in my head.
Yeah, that's rough.
I killed that boy. We could have saved him together.
You didn't have a choice. You think you do when you look back on it. But in a moment, when things are really out of control, you don't have any choice.
I guess.
Try to let it go.
And I think what he was trying to get there is that sometimes you just work off of instinct and whatever feels right. And that really depends on all the other situations and experiences that you've had in your life at that point. And that's why, also going back to what you were saying earlier, it's not fair to have your 18-year-old self decide who you marry, what college you go to, what job you get. When you're 48 and you're like, I don't like any of this. I've given it 30 years of trying and none of it works for me. So I'm going to wipe the slate clean and try again. So there are times where in the series, people do complain like, no matter what I do, this person dies in like the last 5 minutes of this episode anyway. So what's the point of me having this conversation with them or trying to save them earlier in the episode or so on and so forth? Sometimes life might seem like you have a choice, but it's an illusion to a point because there are so many other factors that come in, either the environment or other people's reactions. You can't predict all of those things, or you've done CPR 100 times in your life, which is ridiculous. Only like medical professionals or doctors can really say that. But the 101th time, you just weren't doing the compressions hard enough because you were just too tired and that person didn't make it. That doesn't mean that you didn't make the right choices. That doesn't mean that you're a bad person. It's just the situation got out of control and out of hand. And in the end, either it may be divine intervention, depending on what you believe in, or karma, or if you don't believe in anything and this is just the way that the world is and nothing really matters and it's existential and none of our choices mean anything and we just do them because it makes us feel better.
Hey, I happen to fancy myself an existentialist, and I think the world is what you make of it. So I don't think nothing matters, but I think you make it matter.
Yeah, I mean, the perspective of the world only matters because I'm the only person who is experiencing the world, and everyone else, of course, is a part of it, but in the end, like, no one matters but me, sort of thing. I think that's more of, like, Nietzsche existentialism.
There are different
yeah, of course, so many different branches that,
but yeah, I do, I happen to fall in the, like, you can make the best of, like, life is what you make it, so you know.
It definitely is. I mean, there's a lot of, even with, like, mental health issues, a lot of the therapies, the talk therapies with professionals, there's cognitive based therapy especially, is basically stop looking at life so negatively and it fixes a lot of your issues.
Yeah.
And of course that doesn't work for everyone. And a lot of people do need medication and also a lot of professional intervention combinations to get over these humps. But it's definitely possible for the majority of people who are suffering from these things.
Yeah. I've heard nothing but good things about cognitive therapy.
It's good. I mean, even if you're not someone who suffers from clinical or daily anxiety or depression or post-traumatic stress disorder, just being able to know the basic workbook functions of, okay, what you do is look yourself in the mirror and say, I am beautiful. I am strong. I am worth the job position that I'm in right now. I am doing great things, and I am touching other people's lives.
At first,
right? Because it's like,
and you're like, I've tried that, and that's gross and uncomfortable, and it doesn't work for me. You haven't been doing it long enough,
right?
You got to keep going.
Do it enough to the point where it's comfortable, and then you start believing it. Because if you're constantly telling yourself,
you really do,
I am gross, I am insignificant, I am depressed, I am a horrible person, you keep saying that to yourself, you're going to start believing it. So why isn't the opposite true? Yeah. Well, it is. So
it is. I remember when I first started doing that, it was very difficult for me, and I fought it so hard. I was like, oh, why? You know, it's like a little ever-present voice in my brain would be like, immediately, no. I'd say, like, I can do this. No, you can't. It was just awful. But eventually, you do it long enough, and that's not as present.
Right.
Or it's easier to ignore, or it doesn't feel as strong or as powerful. At least for me, that was my personal experience with that. But
I agree.
I have a question for you to kind of sort of bring it back to the game, just because I am really curious. At the very end, what did you choose with Lee? Did you leave him or...
I had Clementine shoot him every single time.
What?
Yes.
Partially why?
Because I wanted her to have closure, to know that he never turned into a monster. And that...
Interesting.
She would never have to encounter him as a zombie, because they can shamble for miles and miles. What if she sees him again, sort of thing.
Yeah.
And then also to partially toughen her up and realize that all good things come to an end, and we can have a wonderful relationship with a significant other or have a great partnership with a professor all throughout university. But eventually those things do end a lot of times for a lot of people, and you'll never see that professor again. Maybe at a reunion, maybe at an email, please give me a recommendation. But like, that relationship will never be the same. Mm-hmm. And so coming back to having that closure and making sure, like, we had a wonderful journey. You taught her a lot. You made sure that she survived, and she's a slightly tougher 9-year-old girl than most of them out there right now. That's why I did it.
That's a really good answer.
That's what it's about.
That's a really good answer.
What's most important, as I guess, like, cheesy as it sounds, like, it is about the journey a lot more than the destination, you know?
I mean,
I feel that for sure.
There's plenty of times where, like, I might be wishful and like, oh, I wish my friendship with so-and-so was better, or I wish we didn't stop talking. But there's reasons for that. And you could try to rekindle it sometimes. And sometimes there are friends that I have. I have, like, one friend from high school. I text him once every, like, 6 months, and, like, one of his favorite movies is Kill Bill. And I'm like, oh, I finally saw it. And he's like, oh, my God, great. That's awesome. Hope you're well. You know, this is what's going on in my life. How's yours? Okay, great. And then we just...
Yeah.
You know, we won't talk again. And that's okay. That's just the way that our relationship is. And there's some people who just do not adhere to that idea or do not accept that idea that things do evolve, and sometimes things wax and wane and ebb and flow, and seasons, sometimes it can come back strong, and other times, like, it's just too far gone and you've changed too much as people, or your life situations have changed and that's it and you have to move on. So learning how to be adaptable in that way is very important too.
Yeah, it's super important. Yeah. I wish more people didn't see that as a personal failure. Like, oh,
me too.
we are moved on from this relationship. I still wish the best for them.
Exactly.
Kind of thing, but it doesn't mean that I am not a friend, or I'm not worth having as a friend, or that our friendship has failed because it dwindled out. Because that's just how life goes. You know, you will have moments where you'll have people, you know, that you hang out with like every day for months and months and months, and then just you don't anymore, you know?
Yeah, because I mean, the best example of that is like someone that you've known from kindergarten to high school, and then, you know, you graduate high school and you're both going to different colleges. That friendship doesn't have to go away. You can still talk to each other, but you experience college together, and there's so much growth that happens when you become from a teenager to a young adult, and so many different things change about you. So like you come back at summer vacation and you could, like, you know, get together back like peanut butter and jelly and stuff, and you continue this lifelong adult friendship and everything. But that's so rare. That doesn't happen very often. Like, I feel like I have a friend of a friend who has a friendship like that, and I'm like, oh, I wish I had that. But like, I don't feel like most people do. So, because you either live in different states, you went into different jobs, you both have significant others, one of you had a kid. So it's like, And so it's like, oh, we really used to love listening to music together and watching horror movies, and now neither one of us are really into that anymore, and that was a huge part of our relationship. So yeah, I care about you. Yeah. I like you. I'll send you a Christmas letter or something, but other than that, we're done, and that's okay.
Yeah, like, that's, you know, it took me a long time to kind of get to that point to understand that that wasn't necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah,
you know, and for me, it was people who I met in college, you know, like I met that was, you know, and I certainly don't want to cheapen any relationships that I had prior to that with any friends or anything like that. But also, it was just kind of like, you know, when I left home and sort of like set out on my own to kind of like figure myself out a little bit. And I met these people who I grew to care about very deeply. Whereas, and, you know, I look at it now and, you know, it's like, okay, I speak to these people like maybe once every couple of months. And, you know, every once in a while, some of them are like, you know, show up at the stream, which is kind of cool, and they'll say hi, you know, or whatever. And it takes a long time, at least it did for me, to learn that doesn't decrease the worth of that relationship. Yes. Like, I still have love for these people. I still care about them just like I did, but your lives change, and that means that you're not going to talk every day, but it doesn't mean that anything has ended or that it's over. Yeah. It just means that it's different.
Yeah.
Right.
Or that it doesn't make that part of your life any less beautiful. You know, like, wow, exactly. That was a beautiful relationship. That was a beautiful season of my life where I had this person at the forefront, but they're not anymore. But that doesn't mean that I need to feel such weird nostalgia or longing or sadness when I look back at that period of my life and say, I don't have that anymore. Instead of being,
I don't need
like,
to feel like an asshole. Like, what did I do wrong? You know,
nothing. Like, it just, like, that's what
or
happens.
What did they do wrong? You know, if that's the first reaction that you have, like, you know, you start to like pick everything apart and oh, well, they said this one thing 6 months ago and that's why we don't hang out anymore. And it's like, no, like, that's not that's not what it's about.
That's not how that goes down.
But that's the way Kenny works.
That is the way Kenny works. Kenny is so frustrating. I love him, but he's very frustrating. Yeah. I did not have Clem do that thing. And I know you just made a very compelling argument. So I'm like sort of doubting myself and trying to remember why I did the choice that I did. But I was really solid when I made it. And I think it was just, A, he's not going anywhere. B, yes, she is going to have to make a tough life decision and like toughen up, but this is tough enough. Like, leaving him behind and knowing that he's dying is tough enough. Does she really have to shoot him in the head
to learn that lesson? I know, it just felt more humane for both of them. They have a definite end. She just found out, like, you know, she just saw her parents out in the street as well too. So all of her parental figures, so
Yeah.
I was bawling the last 5 minutes of that game. It was so difficult, and I loved it. I love how it made me feel, because it's just a typical like parental or guardianship relationship, and those things end like either you don't see your parents as your parents anymore, they're just adults that are slightly older than you, or you know, you see your teacher outside of school and then you realize, oh my god, they are a regular human being, like that disillusionment,
then
like
you get
drops.
Older and you get friends that are teachers and you're like, oh, this is weird.
yes definitely.
Mm-hmm. I do feel like you can have closure without shooting him in the head, though. You know, you can know that's it, he's gonna die. He does, doesn't he? Like, his eyes close and he goes, and then she just leaves before he becomes a zombie. Right. It sucks that he has to then become a zombie, but I feel like if that were me, I wouldn't want my baby sister to have to shoot me in the head. Like, I know I'm going. Go. I know this is hard enough as it is. We're both, like, crying. The only thing that I wish that he had said was I love you. I wish that there had been that moment where it was like, you know, not maybe if he doesn't want to use the L word, which everybody's afraid to use,
I care for you
yeah. Or you know, you made
thank you for everything.
Yeah, like you oof. You made this, you made me want to live till tomorrow, like thank you. Yeah. Like mm-hmm. that I wanted that, but the only option that you get is like, I'll miss you. And that to me felt so wrong, because you're not going to miss her. You're going to be dead. So, you know, like that's a haunting thing. I feel like for a young child to hear is like, oh, I will miss you, as if you are the one leaving and you can do something different to prevent this from happening. So I didn't like that option, but.
If she hadn't seen her parents in the streets, do you think that you would have been more inclined to shoot Lee? And let me explain myself a little bit here, because she is a child. Mm-hmm. You know, I understand that, you know, she's growing up in this time where, you know, you can't really always reliably say, oh, well, she's just a kid, so she's not going to be able to react appropriately or anything like that. But I kind of wonder if she hadn't seen her parents in the street before that happened, if she would have had a much stronger sense of like fantasy and belief that she could see these people again. Does that make sense? Whereas
I actually,
you know, now that she has it in front of her face, you know, it's like, you know, it would be easier for her and it would make more sense to
You are absolutely right. If she hadn't seen her parents, I probably would have been more inclined to let her shoot him, but because she had just seen all of that, I was like, she's literally losing all of the people that she knows in like a span of 10 minutes. This can crack people. This is a thing that like breaks people, not just like toughens them up for the future. So, and you know, you can have, there are moments where you shoot somebody in the head, and then there are moments where you don't need to do that thing.
Where you leave you know, them behind. Like,
where you can just, you're going to have both, you know, you're going to have both in your life. And, you know, I feel like she learned everything that she needed to learn in that tough day of covering herself in guts and seeing her parents and
getting kidnapped
and leaving him behind and the woman's head in the bag. Like, there was just so much there. It's like, I feel like looking at a young child, I would say that's, you know, I wanted to go there because I thought my parents were still there, but they were zombies. And then I got kidnapped by this guy, and then Lee died because of me. Like, all of that stuff she's going to carry anyway. Why just add shooting me in the head, basically, to that? You know, I don't want her, every time she thinks of me, to think of shooting me in the head as the last thing that she thinks of. Which is, when you have a kid when anybody shoots somebody, but specifically a young child has to do such a traumatic thing, that's immediately, they're going to think Lee, bam, and they're going to transport to the moment that they shot him in the head. And I just don't want that for her. She's too precious. She's my snowflake. Too pure for this world.
I can't wait for you to play season 3 then.
Oh, geez. Oh, God. I actually cried harder season 2. Did I? I felt more upset through season 2 than I did season 1. I think I cried harder season 1. Season 2 toughened me up a bit. I was not expecting that. I But it was perfect. But we'll talk about that another day. We'll talk about season two because there's so much that I could talk about.
Mm-hmm.
Season two. So we wanna call that a wrap, guys?
I think so.
We've been talking for quite
a
while.
That was really great.
Yeah, it was amazing.
Thank you, Jesse, for joining us
that
for this. This was
incredible.
Absolutely wonderful.
I don't know how much of the game that we've talked about, but I really like the conversation.
Yeah,
so.
That's typical, actually. That's typical.
Okay, good.
Of our
that's what it's
dives,
about.
Yeah.
That's what every episode that we've recorded has been, and that's what the deep dive is about.
Yeah. Like I have so many
us,
notes.
What it means to us.
And like I didn't get to any of them except for like the one Lee quote. Like,
Well, we thought about this with Life is Strange, and I would probably like to do this with The Walking Dead as well, where we just do an episode where it's like, Lee, go. And then we talk about the specific character.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I would love to do that. And obviously we still have to talk about season two. So if you would like to be our resident expert on The Walking Dead, we would love to have you back.
I could do that. Yeah.
Yeah. For
I'd like that a lot.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Thank you so much for being here with us today, Jesse. Would you like to once again remind everybody where they can find you on the internet?
Yes, thank you very much for having me yet again. And my name is Jesse Quill. It is 1L, JESSYQUIL on Twitch and Twitter mostly, but I also have an Instagram, Facebook, a website, jessiequill.tv, YouTube with stream highlights and so on. So basically, if you Google me, you'll find me.
Yep. Also, we will have links in the description, as always, for every episode. So you can find her there if you're curious. Thank you. That was amazing.
Thank you.
Thanks. I had a lot of fun.
The Deep Dive Cast is brought to you by PBTV. You can find us at deepdivecast.com as well as on Twitter and Instagram at deepdivecast. If you enjoyed what you heard today, please consider rating and reviewing us on iTunes. That would really help us out a lot. And if you'd like to support us additionally, please consider visiting our Patreon at Pumpkinberry. Patrons receive various perks such as monthly black and white wallpapers, bonus episode content, and the knowledge that you, the listener, are keeping the deep dive afloat. Be sure to join us every Monday morning at 7 a.m. Eastern when we premiere each new episode live and have a deep dive discussion with you right there in chat at twitch.tv/pumpkinberry. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll catch you next time, divers.
The Deep Dive podcast is proudly part of the Geek Generation Network. For more podcasts about your favorite geeky things like games or your favorite shows, browse our whole library at thegeekgeneration.com.